1995. The speaker is Charles Vincent Lucier, age 68. I was born November 20th, 1926, and will be 69 on November 20th, 1995. The subject will be the Seward Peninsula digs and background of the work done by Larson and Lucier in 1949. And I have some original notes to go on. They're incomplete, unfortunately. I have a spiral notebook and a smaller elementary school pulp notebook. With the latter, with the seven or eight pages torn out. There are eight pages missing, and there's one loose page. So I can, if need be, refer to them. I'm going to try, just speaking extemporaneously, mainly, without too many ahs and ahs. That's why I'm recording this over. But I may decide to read excerpts from the journal. I'm going to cover the last part of the trip first on the tape so that it may be some use to so that it may be of some use to Gene Schaff and to Francine Taylor in their recent work on a video presentation for the land bridge. So I'll be either giving very little or nothing on the Teller and Port Clarence portion of the summer of 1949. There were on this trip, there were just two of us, Helge Larson, H-E-L-G-E, Helge, which is also a woman's name, I understand, and Charles Lucier, with the middle name Vincent, saints' names, of course. And Helge was born, I believe his birthday was early in the year, I don't know if it was January or February. He was born in 1905, therefore he's about 10 or 11 months, say 10 months older than my father, who was born in December 1905. Helge's Danish, and however, he lived in the U.S. during World War II and made several trips and stays in Alaska and New York City. He was just on the edge of things. But he was very interested in American culture and Americans, and I would say was rather pro-American with intelligent reservations. And Helge was born on the same island, I should know the name, I don't, on which Copenhagen resides. And he was, as far as I know, he was born in Copenhagen itself, and perhaps in the center of the city, in an area he pointed out to me of old sort of uniform-looking buildings, somewhat grime-colored, covered, and he referred to as a slum now. But I think it was not in American terms a slum in 1979 when he pointed this out. But anyway, he grew up there, and then somewhere around 1922 or so, I believe it was, 21, 22, something like that, when he was a teenager, his father built a substantial brick home with a full basement and a ground floor and a second floor, a half story with dormers in sort of a Danish Dutch looking to me, and some of the houses around there actually did look Dutch, and he said that's because of the king back so many years ago had imported Dutch workmen, and that's all the influence of the Dutch architecture in Copenhagen. Helge told me quite a bit about himself some rather intimate things in 1949, and then he told me about his father and some other things about himself, but not in great detail, in 1979. In 1949, he was 44 years old, of course, and then in the 1979, he would have been in his mid-70s, say pushing 75. And he died February 14th, 1984, and I believe the cause of his death was clogged leg arteries and he had, or veins, and he had a rather difficult time of the latter years, especially after Gerda, his wife, died in, I believe it was April, perhaps, of 1979. That would have been just 4 or 5 months before I came. I was there in November for several weeks. And while I was there, we were traveling on a bus to the famous Shakespeare's Hamlet's castle, and he pointed and said, "Oh, my father used to come along here when he was about 15 years old, driving a one-horse cart loaded with charcoal, and when he would go through each little village, the boys would throw rocks at him. It was like going through a gauntlet. And then he'd go into Copenhagen and sell his load of charcoal, I don't know, to a wholesaler, to individuals, I don't know. And then he would come back, I guess, through the gauntlet again. And he lived in what we might now consider a peasant house, a one-story brick, as I recall, probably brick, and long and relatively narrow in relation to its length, and divided into two parts, a living, general living area in front with a stove and heating and little bunks in which he said that people didn't lie down to sleep, they sat up to sleep. That was why I asked him why they were very short. And there was a table there. This was, he said, the house was like the one his father lived in. This was a historical village. And he said that this table, there was a trestle-type table, and behind it there was this sort of north or northwest European interior that I'd seen before, of plate holders along the wall, and then there were a place for some spoons hang on the wall, and then this table in front of it, and there was a bench that was just directly behind the table against the wall, and there was none in front. And Helya said, oh, that the men and bigger boys would sit down to eat, and the wife and other adult women and girls would stand at the front of the table and eat. They didn't have chairs or benches. And when we went back into the rear work area, which had a wall dividing it from this main part of this house with the wood floors, it was a sand-covered area floor. It had no wooden floor. And as we were looking, when I looked around, he pointed over to the near corner on the left, facing the rear of the, and he said, my father used to come back like this, house like this, and he'd go and pee in the sand, I suppose, at night, in back there. And this struck home to me because I had done almost the same thing when I was a boy in Abilene, Kansas, and my father led the way in this mischief. And I would come through my parents' bedroom and exit the door onto the veranda and stand there and pee off the porch into the sand, just like my father did. And much to my mother's complaint, she was not at all stuffy, but she complained that it didn't smell very good. But I would persist in it. And of course, the last time I did this, when I was 12 years old, and I left soon after that. So I felt that Helya's father and I had something in common. across the Atlantic Ocean and generations of Frenchness and what. And his father was, at some point, I don't know his education history, but he moved, obviously, to Copenhagen, and he became an officer in the bank. And I assume stayed in the bank until he was retirement age. And as I say, in the early 20s, he built this fairly, rather substantial house in what was then a growing suburb of Copenhagen, and which had been just farms with alleys, with poppers along them, and it'd be filled in with these middle-class houses. And Helge said, this is Gentofte is one of the richest cities in Denmark. And when I asked him about all the Oriental rug stores, he said, because people invest in rugs to get around taxes. And indeed, Helge had very nice rugs. And he had, of course, a beautiful collection of books of which he was very proud, and which he said was very valuable. That he said it made him, he was rich. But I think he was rich only in Danish terms. I don't think he was rich in American terms. I don't know exactly the route it was, but he became involved in archaeology, perhaps through Terkel Mathiasen or another through Goodman Hott or some other person in anthropology, and was assigned to, instead of going into high school, or he said that he was trained as a teacher of geology in the gymnasium, which is sometimes translated as high school, but which Helge thought was probably more the equivalent of American college, a four-year or two or four-year college, whatever. Anyway, he was to be teaching in the gymnasium. However, once he went to Greenland, and I believe that it was when he was either before he was married or that he was in Greenland when he was married. And this would have been in the late 20s, I believe, when he was in his, say, mid-20s. And so he was sidetracked or routed away from teaching geology. But he kept that interest and had the habits of a scientist. He said that he first dug at Dudenvonbutten, I believe is the place, in eastern Greenland or northeastern Greenland. And so he was put on the track of Greenlandic Eskimo studies and was most interested in that all his life, in Antarctic generally. He first was, as far as I know, the first time he came, and I'm not sure of the route that he took to gain that, was came to Point Hope in 1939. It may have been through Frederica de Laguna or some other route that I don't believe that I... He probably told me, but I don't remember. Anyway, he was there with Froelich Rainey and James Louis Giddings, or J.L. Giddings, in 1939, and I believe that he was stranded in 1940 when the Nazis invaded the Low Countries and Denmark and Norway. So he was stranded in Denmark, but early on in the war, he, you might say, made an escape or exit, very unusual, from his homeland, Denmark, and he was a very patriotic person, so one can't credit that to, you know, any sympathies with anything other than the Danes, But I believe, according to what Helya said, that Frederik Reinie was the agent for his leaving Denmark with Gerda and little Ola. And according to Helya, he said, well, I would have been shot, or probably would have been shot, if I'd stayed here. And indeed, I'm sure they had hostages were taken. And Helya tended to be, when he was angry, was rather outspoken. And he said that when early on in the war, after the occupation, that a friend, a German friend, anthropologist, came in and he shouted at him to get out of there. What did he think coming in wearing that uniform, Nazi uniform? And Frederik Reinie credits his exit to the work of goodwill of Goodman Hott, but I really don't believe that, since Helya said that Frederik was the person who got him out. And this took some dealings and wheelings and dealings with the Gestapo, I suppose, with the German military occupation and everything in between, till he got to Lisbon. And I didn't ask how. I assumed that he flew over in a flying boat, and all of this is quite expensive and difficult, and was not the route that many people took. So, and when Frederik Reinie, in his autobiography, credits this to Goodman Hott and doesn't explain at all how he was involved, which is rather incredible. Nevertheless, Helius was, as a result, and Gerrit, his wife, and small boy, were in New York throughout the war. And they lived rather well by any standard, because, according to Helya, Junius Bird had loaned him his, what Helya described as, a mansion on the Hudson River. And Junius was, as I understand, married to a very wealthy woman, as many archaeologists are. And so he, during that time, then he worked on the Eputak report, very fine piece of work, large, and had the facilities of the Museum of Natural History to help him do so. But he did this without Frederik Reinie. Reinie was involved with intelligence work. I believe it's, you know, partly spying, or he worked, it was either, it's not clear what it was when I read the autobiography, but anyway, it may have been with the State Department and with other agencies that now are other than State Department intelligence or spying agencies. So he went through, and Helya also, I believe, was in Alaska for a short time in the Aleutians, perhaps, in during the World War II. But he did not do any major work during the war, of course. And Giddings was in the military, and Frohlich, as I said, was occupied in Europe as an officer in this in civil administration and in spying. So he went back to Denmark, and then the earliest I know was when he came back in 1948 with a Danish linguist, and Owen Rye from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I suppose that J. Louis Giddings, was the person who picked out Owen Rye to go with him down to the mouth of the Kuskokwim and the Delta area, down below there, Shagbon Bay and so on. So he had come back in 1948, and in the interim, or about that time, Eskil Anderson, who was a mining graduate, and he may have worked for Mining Extension, I'm not quite sure on Eskil's occupation at the time, but anyway, he had been involved around Seward Peninsula, and through Mrs. Peterson at Teller had found, she had shown him, and he had brought back to the university a very beautiful Putak rake-like object from a grave on Point Spencer. And also, I believe that Eskil was the vehicle by which several late prehistoric, it seemed to me, my memory is right, antler barbed arrowheads from cave, what would be Cave 2 at Trail Creek, came into the possession of the anthropology department at the University of Alaska, then called College rather than Fairbanks. And so Giddings, no doubt, through Giddings and Ivor Scarland received this material through an information through Eskil Anderson. And so on that basis, Helya, who was interested in a Putak still, since he found something he called, probably he might have called then near a Putak or the Shagman Bay material, and it wasn't clear how this related to the Putak material, he was interested in trying to figure this problem out about a Putak and its origins, and he was heavily influenced by the Danish theorists, and Goodman Hott was one of his big influences about the inland origins of Eskimos, and I suppose picked up from the Central Arctic and somewhat. So this was sort of what carried Helya along, this theory of inland Eskimo origins and this mystery of Putak. And also there was a chance of producing spectacular material. And Helya was not a stupid person, and he, as like most archaeologists, he wanted to have something to show for his efforts, and he wanted to be as spectacular as possible. He wasn't going to waste his time just doing historical archaeology, turning up nondescript things. So that's what got him back in 1949, and in order to do this, he needed a helper. So he asked Louis, and Louis talked it over with Ivor Scarland, and Scarland pushed me as an assistant. I was not a very well educated in anthropology as compared to many of the students. I was not an anthropology major even. I was a biology major with an undergraduate degree, but Ivor just liked me and thought I was capable, and he recommended me very strongly. He kept pushing me with Giddings, and Giddings was a very cautious man in many ways, and I don't know if he was reluctant to take me, but anyway, he did apparently recommend me, and I was picked out to go with Larson. And the first date that I have on this first notebook is June 6th, when I met Larson at Giddings' house. And Giddings then was living in something that was rather pretentiously called the Rainy House, which is a log house, I hope, which still exists, up on the ridge, what was then quite a bit away from the main campus, toward the experimental station. And then on June 7th we left. And so the first part of the summer, rather a long summer compared to many of them, and then we came back on August 25th, leaving Deering on that date, arriving in Nome, and then we arrived back in Fairbanks on August 26th of 1949. So this was a rather long and fairly arduous summer, with a lot of physical effort and a lot of interesting things. As I said, I don't have the dates for the departure from Port Clarence, Teller Port Clarence, on the mailboat Kotzebue, and I don't even have the arrival date with certainty in Kotzebue. Since the second so-called Whopper notebook, trade name Whopper notebook, begins in mid-entry, and the next day mentioned is 27th, I assume that we went to Deering from Kotzebue on July 26th, 1949. And we traveled with Gene Joyner. Now, Helya was planning, I'm sure, to travel on a larger aircraft. But Joyner, who was very aggressive, and even then, obviously, a bit eccentric, but very aggressive and a pretty good talker, persuaded Helya to go with him rather than, say, we could have gone with, say, with Wien Airlines and one of their very fine new Cessnas, almost new Cessnas. But it turned out that he had a Cub aircraft. It was a two-place aircraft, and he misrepresented it to Helya, and we got there and he proceeded to throwing in our stuff, and Helya was very unhappy, but he'd agreed to this and was a person who usually would stick to his word. I mean, always would, as far as I know. So we got into this Cub, which was not very well maintained anyway, and Piper, and then Joyner proceeded to pile things all around us, duffel bags and this on us and around us and back of us, so that the plane was completely stuffed. And when we took off from Kotzebue, I believe it was on that little field, not the main FAA, or what was then called the CAA, the Civil Aeronautics Administration field, but rather that little one in back of town then, that the bush pilots used and local pilots. So we took off and lumbered, you know, like we wondered if we're going to make it, just lumbered across Kotzebue Sound with this, and with Helya very unhappy, and I was crammed in with this stuff that we could hardly see out because of all this stuff we had on board, and we didn't have all of it. So when we landed, we of course landed on the airfield at Deering, which is on the west end of town, was a rather new airfield. It had been created just by scraping off the front gravel bar of Deering, west of the build-up area of town. And so we didn't have all our stuff, so we waited for him to bring more of it in this darn little Cub. On the notebook, I want to read a little bit here of considerable interest. When we landed at Deering, our gear was unloaded, and Joyner departed for Kotzebue to get the remainder of our stuff. We waited for Joyner for several hours, and among other things, talked to Taylor Moto Sr. about the Trail Creek caves. Taylor said that he had been stormbound at the cave, and I'll paraphrase my somewhat chopped down notes. That'd be number two, as Larson named it later. And he had been stranded in this cave along with his brother-in-law, Alfred Carman, in late January 1928. They were unable to find sufficient shelter for their tent in among the willows, and so the two men looked for a better location, and by chance, Taylor spotted the opening to one of the caves, and they investigated. The cave had a low entrance tunnel, but an inner chamber had plenty of headroom and would have accommodated a small family, Taylor said. They tied up the dogs and settled down inside the cave. He said that when the primus stove was working, the temperature was too warm inside and they were forced to remove parkas. They remained in the cave 5 days until the weather improved. While he was there, Taylor found some arrowheads on a narrow shelf of rock along the right wall of the chamber. And when he scratched about in the dirt below this, he found a large worked flint object, seemingly an arrow, and I've scratched out in my notes and put spearhead and barbed, and so it, and so probably it seems a little bit confused because you cannot have a barbed flint object. But anyway, he found these hunting implements in the back of the cave, and it kept them all these years. Now, I'm not sure whether he kept them or whether his brother-in-law kept them, but they were kept all those many years from 1928 till 1948 or 49. And so we had some time to kill, so we were just looking around at the airport that day, and we were, of course, planning on going up to the caves. And I assume that there had been some communications with Taylor or someone else in town there, it must have been Taylor, beforehand about us going to the caves, because he was informed about it. And while we're standing on the